architects of Bethlehem steel czar Charles Schwab. Shortly thereafter, he designed and built Schwab's new mansion. He also secured loans from the steel magnate to finance a series of real estate ventures. By 1910, de Bobbio was back in New York, earning his way by designing churches and constructing large apartment buildings in Manhattan and the Bronx. Playing fast and loose with Schwab's capital, de Bobbio returned to Ohio, where he crossed the border into West Virginia and Kentucky to purchase 11,000 acres. Now well-connected, the Hungarian offered to set up a syndicate of wealthy English steelmen to help refinance Wardenclyffe, promising to raise £1 million, without going to very much trouble, providing, of course, that we could demonstrate things to them satisfactorily. But Tesla declined the offer and resolved to fight my own battles. Known as a racketeer, having never paid taxes on the land deal, de Bobbio also reneged on a series of other loans. Naturally, Schwab became angry, particularly because he had lent de Bobbio additional monies to keep him out of debtor's prison. Paradoxically, de Bobbio became interested in workers' rights at this time and in the growing anarchist movement. Seen as a gold digger and bully by Schwab, the wealthy financier was reported to have said that Bob is dishonest, and I would give $1 million if he would jump out of this window right now. This event unleashed a powder keg of animosity between the two, de Bobbio suing Schwab for $100,000 for defamation of character, Schwab severing connections between his niece and de Bobbio and the family. Attracted to violent activities, de Bobbio continued to associate with a variety of radical and paramilitary groups. He also caught the eye of the Secret Service. In 1923, during a bizarre interlude, de Bobbio returned to his home in Budapest and aligned himself with a pro-Hitler group. There he authored a paper which attacked Jewish physics and espoused the developing New World Order. Charged with conspiring to overthrow the Hungarian government, he escaped back to America. Throughout this entire period, de Bobbio would regularly correspond with Tesla to discuss various ideas he had, such as how to perfect a projector bomb which he had a patent pending on, and he also discussed his latest encounter with a cabal of international warlords. The following letter suggests the possibility that Tesla's attacking Einstein may have been prompted by anti-Semitic sentiments as much as by philosophical differences. Munitions Incorporated, 295 Madison Avenue, New York, New York. My dear Mr. Tesla, I hugely enjoyed your comments on relativity, which we, way back in 1921, attacked in my Budapest paper as a theory of the fundamentals of which, if logically developed, would inevitably lead to an anthropomorphic Jehovah with all the evil trimmings in philosophy and social order. Yours sincerely, Titus de Bobbio. In full support of Tesla's desire to resurrect a new Wardenclyffe, de Bobbio carefully drafted for Tesla blueprints for a 120-foot-tall teleforce powerhouse and transmission tower. At the same time, he set up a factory for his munitions company in New Jersey with Captain Hans Teuscher. The tower, set up somewhat like a high-tech Van de Graaff generator with Van de Graaff's primitive cardboard belt replaced by a vacuum stream of ionized air, had at its bulbous apex a turret-rotating particle beam cannon, able to move about to attack planes and airships with information provided by an earth current radar system the wizard had also designed during his days at Wardenclyffe. Tauscher, a German-American, was closely linked with the fatherland through his daughter, who still lived there. Through this and other channels, Tesla could be introduced to potential weapons buyers. Simultaneously, he could also be supplied with small amounts of dynamite, which he used to test telegeodynamic equipment that he was trying to sell to such companies as Texaco Oil Company for geophysical exploration. Titus de Bobbio was now making his living selling rifle grenades, fragmentation and gas bombs and other armaments to both domestic police departments and foreign governments in Europe and South America. Unfortunately for the Hungarian, unwished-for newspaper publicity concerning a lawsuit with Teuscher drew the attention of the Internal Revenue Service, IRS. Having hid his relationship with the munitions factory, de Bobbio not only attracted the tax collectors, but also the seemingly omniscient J. Edgar Hoover, who monitored his activities for the next 10 years. He was accused of being a German agent and illegal alien involved in subversive activities, and Hoover recommended that Dubobula be considered for custodial detention in the event of a national emergency. Although they maintained their relationship during this stormy period, Tesla's antennae were raised, especially when Dubobula requested loans from him in amounts you would not miss, just at the time he declared bankruptcy. Dubobula was $750,000 in debt. Hoping to make Tesla a partner in the company, Dubobula raised Tesla's ire when he used his name as a reference when working an arms deal with the Minister of Paraguay. Tesla called Dubobula and stated emphatically that he was not to use the inventor's name. Unable to maintain his Manhattan apartment, Dubobula moved to the Bronx, where he was eventually arrested. A search of his apartment revealed an arsenal of hand grenades, dynamite, and tear gas bombs. The architect claimed they were simply part of the inventory from his company, and he was interrogated and released. Presumably an anti-Semite who apparently had ties to Henry Ford, Dubobula disavowed any relationship to either the Communist Party or the German-American Bund. Although he was monitored throughout the World War II years, the Federal Bureau of Investigation was unable to prove that he had violated any federal statute, and Dubobula was allowed to move to Washington, D.C., where he set up another munitions arsenal right in the heart of the city. In 1949, he wrote directly to J. Edgar Hoover to get them off his back, and apparently Hoover complied, as articles and references to him faded away at that time. As the Great Depression wore on, Tesla's expenses continued to mount. He was now $400 in debt to the hotel, which, during those dreary days, was a considerable sum. Cornered by the management, the sly conceptualist fell back on a stratagem that had worked so well when he was at the Waldorf Astoria. He would live on credit. He thereupon offered as collateral a working model of his death ray, which he told the establishment was worth $10,000. They asked for a receipt in writing, and he agreed. The treacherous device and his note were carefully placed in locker number 103 in the hotel's backroom vault. Although he had solved the problem of meeting the rent, Tesla's finances were still in a precarious state. He was even having trouble coming up with the $15 per month storage costs at the Manhattan storage warehouse. In 1934, with a bitter taste in his mouth, he drafted a long letter to J.P. Morgan, Jr. In it, the inventor revealed that he had made overtures to sell his Chinese wall of defense to war departments in America and England. "The Russians are very anxious to render their border safe against Japanese invasion, and I have made them a proposal which is also being seriously considered." The inventor went on to acknowledge his outstanding debt to Morgan from the turbine affair, and his willingness to pay back the sum, about $40,000, and then made an appeal. "If I had now $25,000 to secure my property and make convincing demonstrations, I could acquire in a short time colossal wealth." Tesla ended the letter by lambasting FDR's New Deal, which poured out billions in public money just so it can remain in power indefinitely. This perpetual motion scheme, in Tesla's view, was anti-democratic, destructive to established industries, and decidedly socialistic. Needless to say, Morgan did not lend Tesla any money. However, what is interesting in this passage is Tesla's reference to property he needed to secure in order to make convincing demonstrations. This suggestion that he had in fact erected a working death ray would become important later, when the question was raised whether a functioning model had actually been constructed. According to Hugo Gernsback, through to his prompting, the Westinghouse Corporation agreed to help their former champion out. Gernsback stated that he had called up the Westinghouse officials in the late 30s to discuss what could be done. "I apprised them of the fact that Tesla was a very proud man who under no circumstances would consider charity. I suggested that perhaps he could be put on the staff in an honorary capacity as a consultant. This was agreed upon, and from that time until his death, Tesla received a modest pension." Gernsback may certainly have called the company. However, his interpretation of what occurred conflicts with the timing of the contract and the reasons for the deal. Tesla had settled with Westinghouse about 4 years before the science fiction publisher's gracious call. On legal footing, the inventor continued to press his case. Finally, on January 2, 1934, the president, F. A. Merrick, acquiesced and agreed to pay Tesla to act as a consulting engineer for $125 a month for such a period as may be mutually agreeable. To solve the aging patriarch's psychological problem of refusing to pay his rent, Merrick also agreed to cover Tesla's rent. The debt owed to the hotel governor was never settled. Rather, Tesla moved, after signing of the agreement, to the Hotel New Yorker, and there he would live, so far as he was concerned, rent-free to the end of his days. 46. Loose Ends, 1931-1943. Then there appeared the vision of a man from a strange new world. A tall, thin man, whose eyes blazed with an unearthly light, entered the room so quietly that one was hardly aware of his presence. He bowed himself to his seat. He beamed upon Viereck and his wife paternally. He greeted the guests with a kindly nod. Before he could be introduced, Tewson blurted out, "Nikola Tesla."
Elmer Geertz.
The first-time ambassador, Stanko Stojakovich, saw the celebrated Serb. He was standing in front of the library with two white pigeons on his arm, pecking seeds from his palm. That was in 1918, and they met only briefly. A decade later, Stojakovich returned to America as an emissary of the Yugoslavian consulate, and they became close friends for the next 10 years. At the age of 90, Stojakovich would recall their visits. As with many other Serbs, Stojakovich was unhappy about the split between Tesla and Pupin, and like others before him, he tried to bring the two men together. Perceiving Pupin as ungrateful and deeply hurt by his association with that donkey, Marconi, Tesla wanted nothing to do with his fellow Serb. The feeling, of course, was mutual.
May 29th, 1931. My dear Mr. Sweezy, I have not seen Mr. Tesla for nearly 20 years. In the beginning of the World War, a difference of opinion created a split between Mr. Tesla and myself. Neither he nor I have ever had, since that time, an opportunity to cure that split. In 1915 I offered, through a mutual friend, to forgive and forget, but somehow the offer was not accepted. I regret, therefore, that I could not transmit to Mr. Tesla a letter of greeting or congratulation on his 75th birthday. Yours very sincerely, M.J. Pupin.
In Dunlap's classic text, Radio's 100 Men of Science, the author writes, "Pupin was a man of complete intellectual honesty. If he made an error in an equation on the blackboard, he would quickly admit the mistake, rub out the blunder, and begin again." We have discussed in the past Pupin's insistence that many of Tesla's inventions were his own, and how Pupin removed Tesla's name from the discussion of the history of the AC polyphase system and of the wireless in his 400-page Pulitzer Prize-winning autobiography, which he had dedicated to the rise of idealism as a qualified witness whose testimony had competence and weight. This tack also carried over to his legendary courses at Columbia University, in which he camouflaged Tesla's role in the etiology of a variety of inventions. When Marconi came to New York in 1927 to lecture, Dr. Pupin presided at the Institute of Radio Engineers. "Marconi, we love you," said Dr. Pupin. "We have come not so much to hear what you have to say, but to see your boyish smile." When Pupin became ill in 1935, he asked his secretary to go and see Stojakovich and plead with him to get Tesla to visit Pupin in the hospital. He wanted to make peace before he passed on. Greeting Stojakovich at the door in his favorite lounging outfit, a red robe with blue slippers, Tesla was taken aback by the request. He said he needed to sleep on the matter. The following day he called his friend and said he would go if Stojakovich would accompany him. In Pupin's room there were a few doctors alongside his bed. The meeting was most touching. Tesla approached the sick man and held his hand out and said, "How are you, my old friend?" Pupin was speechless from emotion. He cried and tears were coming down his face. We all went out of the room and left the two men alone.
Tesla was able to talk with Pupin eye to eye. In parting, Tesla had mentioned that they would meet again in the science clubrooms and converse as before. Immediately after Tesla's visit, Pupin passed away. Tesla attended the funeral.
4 years Tesla's senior, Robert Underwood Johnson left for a tour of England as a widower in 1927 and went again to France and Italy in 1928. Tesla lent his friend $500 for the trip and $800 for the mortgage on his home. Upon his return in 1929, Johnson joined Tesla and Richmond P. Hobson for a movie and an evening out on the town. Hobson, who was living with his wife Griselda at the Hotel Whalen on 54th Street, also had a residence in the nation's capital. Tesla was seeing his friends on a daily basis at this time. Johnson was particularly lonely, even though he had children and grandchildren who frequently came to visit. The following year, now an octogenarian, the old poet set off again for Europe. On this trip, he was hoping to interview Madame Marie Curie. Although Tesla was able to spend much of the 1930s with Johnson, Hobson left the city after only a short stay to purchase a cattle ranch with his son in Vancouver. In April 1937, Tesla forwarded a new biography of his life that had been translated from Serbo-Croatian into English to Johnson, who passed it on to the editor-in-chief of the New York Times. At 85 years of age, Johnson was too weak to write a thank-you letter in his own hand, but he was able to sign it, "R. U. Johnson, Luka Filipov." Both Johnson and Hobson died shortly thereafter. The famous lieutenant, barely 60 years old, was buried in Arlington Cemetery. With the help of Agnes Holden, Robert's daughter, Tesla sent a gorgeous flowering azalea to Griselda, who appreciated greatly the kind thoughts of this dear friend. Another character who stayed friendly with Tesla in the later years was George Sylvester Viereck, Wunderkind poet. Viereck was a sensualist, cynic, and German propagandist during World War I and Nazi spokesman during the 1930s and World War II. Tesla's link to Viereck extended back 30 years to when Gilder and Johnson introduced such provocative Viereck poems as The Haunted House in the Century in 1906, which was a poem about an enchanting partner whose body was, alas, a haunted place. "When I did yield to passion's swift demand," Viereck penned, "one of your lovers touched me with his hand, and in the pang of amorous delight I hear strange voices calling through the night." Viereck, who was probably an illegitimate grandson of Wilhelm II, abdicated Kaiser of Germany, was a multifaceted character and self-proclaimed genius. Having interviewed many of the greatest minds of the epoch, the German-American intellectual had rattled the souls of such individuals as Theodore Roosevelt, George Bernard Shaw, occultist Aleister Crowley, H.G. Wells, Sigmund Freud, Albert Einstein, Kaiser Wilhelm, and Adolf Hitler. A man in intimate contact with his irrational side, Viereck had passed many a day with Sigmund Freud, explicating the great theoretician's libido theory, influencing Freud's writings, and applying the master's psychology to modern life. Freud, Viereck wrote, was motivated not only by a desire to complete his own worldview, but by a belief that each individual represented a special expression of the world spirit. Not an anti-Semite, having, for instance, co-written a series of books with a Jewish professor, Viereck, a lifelong German apologist, was nevertheless somehow able to rationalize the Nazi spiel, and he became an American spokesman for Adolf Hitler. Although Freud saw in this journalistic lion hunter a great mind, he said that Viereck suffered from narcissism, had delusions of persecution, and a fixation on the fatherland. Once Viereck began to rationalize Hitler's rhetoric, Freud saw the journalist as debasing himself and would not correspond with him anymore. During one of the series of interviews Viereck conducted with Tesla, he revealed that Tesla was not a believer in God in the orthodox sense. "To me, the universe is simply a great machine which never came into being and never will end. The human being is no exception to the natural order. What we call the soul or spirit is nothing more than the sum of the functionings of the body. When this function ceases,
the soul or spirit ceases likewise. According to John O'Neill, this meat machine theory was really a ruse used to hide the numerous mystical experiences that Tesla had. On his vision of the 21st century, Tesla foresaw a world in which eugenics would be universally established. Perhaps spurred by Viereck's discussion of the Aryan vision or the iniquitous American practice of sterilizing criminals and some mentally retarded individuals, Tesla supported the idea of sterilizing the unfit and deliberately guiding the mating instinct. A century from now, the celibate concluded, it will no more occur to a normal person to mate with a person eugenically unfit than to marry a habitual criminal. On diet, the slim Epicurean revealed that he had given up meat altogether. Tesla believed that in the future inexpensive and healthy food would be derived from milk, honey, and wheat. As the 1930s progressed, the inventor would continue to live on an ever-receding subsistence diet, moving from meat to fish, to vegetables, and finally to warm milk, bread, and something he called factor actus. Eliminating solid food altogether, the thinning wizard had concocted a health potion made up of a dozen vegetables, including white leeks, cabbage hearts, flour of cauliflower, white turnips, and lettuce hearts. Although he still maintained that he might live to 140, a psychoanalytic view of this regimen of meager victuals could only construe it as an anorexic, unconscious plan for self-extinguishment. Long before the next century dawns, the oracle predicted, systematic reforestation and the scientific management of natural resources will have made an end of all devastating droughts, forest fires, and floods. Long-distance transmission of electrical power by harnessing waterfalls will dispense with the necessity of burning fuel. Robots and thinking machines will replace humans, and the trend of spending more on war and less on education will be reversed. A major reason for this would be Tesla's latest discovery of his defensive shield between nations. If no country can be attacked successfully, there can be no purpose in war. My discovery ends the menace of war. I do not say that there may not be several destructive wars before the world accepts my gift. I may not live to see its acceptance. In the habit of meeting with Viereck and his family at their home on Riverside Drive on a somewhat regular basis, Tesla accepted an invitation to attend a dinner party. Present was Viereck's son Peter. Today, as a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and English professor, Peter remembers Tesla as almost an uncle. Also present was the youthful Elmer Goertz, who at that time was preparing a biography of Viereck. A friend of Carl Sandburg, and also biographer of voluptuary Frank Harris, Goertz would later come to defend such illustrious individuals as Nathan Leopold and Loeb, pornographic writer Henry Miller, and assassin Jack Ruby, in an appeal of the death sentence. At a spry 85 years of age, Goertz remembered the meeting which took place 57 years before, when he was 29. In a communicative mood at the dinner party, Tesla told his life story unostentatiously, simply, with quiet eloquence. He told of his platonic affairs of the heart, explained the inventions that have made the world his debtor, and told of his plans, of his credo, of his foibles. It was a tale of wonders, told with guileless simplicity. Struck by the fact that they were in the same house that had seen Einstein, Sinclair Lewis, and countless others, Goertz noted that Viereck was comparatively silent much of the night, but he was subtly responsible for the intellectual thrills of the evening. Pressed for other details, Goertz revealed that Tesla knew all of Viereck's poems by heart. Tesla also discussed his platonic affair with Sarah Bernhardt, whom he had met while in Paris at the 1889 exposition. Differing with O'Neill's oft-quoted suggestion that Tesla avoided her eyes when he picked up her handkerchief, Goertz said that Tesla had met with her on several occasions, perhaps also in New York. So taken with her was he that Tesla had saved and preserved her scarf without ever washing it, and still had it to that day. Viereck provides a fascinating link between Tesla and Sigmund Freud, self-denial and Eros.
Stajakovich told a story of how he was invited to Tesla's New Yorker apartment, and a valet brought in a bottle of wine in a dish of ice, but Tesla never allowed it to be opened. When this event was replayed another evening, Tesla revealed that he kept the bottle there to prove that he could prevent himself from drinking it. A man of rigid habits, Tesla denied himself certain pleasures as a way to supposedly establish total control over himself. And yet Tesla was a complete slave to his idiosyncrasies and to a cauldron of phobias. Going out of his way to avoid handshakes, displacing his amorous affections onto birds, keeping hotel servants at a distance of at least 3 feet, throwing out collars and gloves after one use, Tesla had other rigid requirements as well. The hotel was requested to keep one table permanently reserved for himself. No one else was allowed to eat there. If a fly landed on the table, it had to be reset and a new plate of food brought forth. When it came to money matters, Tesla also showed little ability to restrain himself, and as we've seen, he habitually refused to honor rent payments. From the Freudian point of view, Tesla was an anal-compulsive personality, fixated in the latent stage of sexual repression with a displacement of his energies into scientific endeavors. By denying his libido, his censor had converted his primal sexual energy into an odd mixture of pre-logical behavior patterns that tended to diffuse, redirect, and sublimate the highly cathected complexes the inventor wished to deny. It appears quite possible that Viereck strove to psychoanalyze Tesla, to have the inventor dig deep into his childhood in an effort to release submerged events that may have blocked or redirected his life in neurotic fashion. Viereck, who was known to partake of opium tincture, probably entered an altered state when conversing with the ethereal prophet. Nearly 80 years old at the time, exceedingly frail and thin, Tesla wrote Viereck a long letter reviewing the traumas of his childhood.
"It was a dismal night with rain falling in torrents. My brother, a youth of 18 and intellectual giant, had died. My mother came to my room, took me in her arms, and whispered almost inaudibly, 'Come and kiss Dane.' I pressed my mouth against the ice-cold lips of my brother, knowing only that something dreadful had happened. My mother put me again to bed, and lingering a little, said with tears streaming, 'God gave me one at midnight, and at midnight took away the other one.'"
Viereck not only wanted Tesla to reactivate the hidden complexes associated with the death of Dane, but also to reflect on the very process of how his fertile mind gave birth to ideas. One can only guess as to whether or not Viereck trod into the realms of Oedipus and Narcissus, dead brother kissing rituals, and Tesla's monastic life of quirks, self-denial, and affection displaced onto feathered friends. In 1937, on his 81st birthday, at a luncheon in his honor, Tesla was bestowed both the Order of the White Lion from the Minister of Czechoslovakia and the Grand Cordon of the White Eagle, the highest order of Yugoslavia, from Regent Prince Paul by order of King Peter. Belgrade also set up an endowment of $600 per month, which they paid to him for the rest of his days. Looking much like an eagle himself, with his long hawk-shaped proboscis accentuated by his extreme leanness, the skeletal inventor followed his annual custom after the award ceremony by playing host to a group of newspaper men at his Hotel New Yorker suite. There, dressed in his finest tuxedo, the wizard read a prepared treatise outlining his latest inventions and plans for contacting nearby planets. Just a few months later, in late autumn, while negotiating with emissaries from the war departments of Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, England, the Soviet Union, and the United States, Tesla was run down by a taxi cab. Refusing to see a doctor, the inventor managed to limp home. He stayed in bed on and off for 6 months. He had cracked 3 ribs. Thus, in May 1938, still in the process of recuperation, he declined an invitation to attend another award ceremony at the National Institute of Immigrant Welfare in honor of him, Felix Frankfurter of Harvard Law School, and Giovanni Martinelli of the Metropolitan Opera. Accepting the award in Tesla's honor was Dr. Paul Rado Savilievich, Professor of Pedagogy at New York University. Rado